Hello, students, and welcome to Class of X, the free internet course on how to read and enjoy the X-Men comics better. I'm your teacher and host, John Reisinger, and today we are talking about the first two episodes of the recent premiere of Disney Plus's X-Men 97 and how the comics can help explain what is happening in the show. So, welcome back to class. Today, we're doing what every student in school ever wants to do for a lesson. We're going to watch TV. The teacher's tired and maybe was up too late last night and just wants to put on a movie or a cartoon. And that's what we're doing today. We're putting on an X-Men cartoon, but a brand new one in the year of 2024. It's been a long time since I have watched an X-Men cartoon, and by golly, I'm happy it's back. So X-Men 97 came out this last Wednesday upon the recording of this episode with a premiere of two episodes. The show is somehow an upgrade from the original, like, amazing show that I love and adore from the 90s. And it's already taking big swings towards iconic and, frankly, legendary X-Men comic moments. So with that all in mind, I wanted to walk fans of the show, those who are watching it and those who want to watch it, you know, through these references and nods, and maybe for even the experts out there who've read the comics, I want to test you on your X knowledge along the way, because I wasn't prepared for how much the show was going to pull from very specific moments from the comics. The original cartoon pulled a lot from, you know, the literary materials and it did with it what it wanted, but it also had its own artistic liberties, a lot of stuff. I mean, the first episode premieres with a brand new character that was not from the comics. So that's a big thing to take a swing at, you know, when you're just coming out with this cartoon based off a comic that's been around at the time, 30 years, 20 plus years. I wanted to kind of like give you guys an idea of like what's going on in this cartoon and what is it based off of, because I feel like there's even more understanding, entertainment, and enjoyment that can be gleaned from this by knowing what the reference material is. That's the whole point of this podcast. Me, a super comic book fan who loves X-Men, just trying to get people to be able to understand the comics, understand the media, and maybe read the comics more. That's all I really want. I just want people to talk about X-Men more and read X-Men more because it brings me so much joy, and I want to spread the joy. So, episode one comes out. It's called To Me, My X. X-Men. I love the title. It's just a story that takes place right after the premiere or the finale of the final season of the original show. Xavier is gone. He is in space somewhere with his girlfriend getting better from being sick. So Jean is top of this episode. She's Prego now. She's got baby. We get to see our good old friends, the Friends of Humanity, being bigots again against mutants. And they're mad that mutants are now sanctioned by the UN. And they use Sentinel tech to look like Mega Man and attack mutants, including someone a lot of you might recognize, Roberto DaCosta. Sorry, said that wrong. And the X-Men, they save the day by hunting down the Friends of Humanity and finding Bolivar Trask, the guy who made Sentinels. And they end up fighting a master mold again, which is kind of like the earliest X-Men stories, and they're fighting Sentinels, and then the episode ends with them defeating the Sentinels, and it's really great. And there's a massive twist. Magneto shows up, and it turns out he's been bequeathed the school and X-Men property according to Xavier's final will and testament. So what do we talk about from this episode that's from the comics? A fair amount. I'm gonna try to get through this moderately rapidly because I want to get through both episodes in this podcast, and I don't want to lose your interest. So Xavier did leave the planet in the Uncanny X-Men comics to go be with his girlfriend. He did it a few times, but the first time I believe he did it was in Uncanny, or this time they're referencing is from Uncanny X-Men 200, and he went to space to get better from being sick. He had, like, in the comics, like a heart attack or something, but alien technology is going to save him, so he's got to go. And so that in itself is where we're taking place in the X-Men comics. Also, just want to address the fact that Morph looks different in this cartoon, but not different from how he looks in the comics. The Morph we all know from the original cartoon in the 90s, he was a new character. He was a Harley Quinn. You know, Harley Quinn was made for Batman the Animated Series, and then made her way into the comics. Same with Morph. Same with X-23 from X-Men Evolution. Morph looks different now, and I think it's because they wanted to finally pay homage to the Morph in the comic books, who was originally depicted in a alternate universe called Age of Apocalypse. And he looks like that. He's stark white, cartoonish features, no hair, no eyebrows, white eyes, that kind of thing. He also makes an appearance, a much longer appearance, in a wonderful story that we covered in an episode on this podcast called The Exiles. And so when you are, this is all the explanation is that he looks like that because he looks like that in the comics. And I believe they're trying to pay like tribute to or reference to that morph. Because a lot of people were like, that's not how he looked in the original comic. Original cartoon. Why does he look different now? It's because they wanted their X-Men comic book fans making the show. Also, we get to see Master Mold. Master Mold's a very, very old villain from the X-Men. We're talking Uncanny X-Men number 15, which wasn't even called Uncanny yet. It was just called X-Men. X-Men number 15 from 1965. That guy is almost 60 years old as a character, and he appears in this very, very fun and silly issue. I highly recommend you go check it out in the digital space, or if you can somehow find a physical copy of Uncanny X-Men number 15, probably more likely in a trade paperback. But he is the machine that Bolivar Trask makes in order to make more Sentinels. He's the assembly line of Sentinels. And as it always goes with AI technology, it decides it knows better than Bolivar, and it tries to decide that, okay, mutants come from humans, so how do we stop mutants? Well, we should just get rid of all the humans. And Bolivar's like, no, you took a bit of a logical leap there. And so Master Mold is this character from way back in the day, and the X-Men have fought iterations of him throughout their history. In fact, we covered in an episode where we talked about Nimrod, that a Master Mold and Nimrod fused, and that's where we got the character Bastion, who's another big no-no villain character for the X-Men. But that's why we're visiting Master Mold in the cartoon. While Xavier is gone, I can't remember from the cartoon they called him dead. I think the X-Men might think he's dead, which also would be, if that was the case, a very common comic book reference. Xavier's died a lot in the comics before even like the X-Men in 2019 instituted the reincarnation, they basically come back to from the dead constantly, the resurrection protocols, couldn't remember the word. This is before resurrection protocols, when they were all dying constantly and all coming back from the dead constantly. But Xavier's died a lot. Xavier died in Uncanny X-Men 42, but it wasn't him, turns out. It was actually Changeling, which, to connect what we were talking about prior a second ago, more from the cartoon, is actually based off of Changeling. But then he also died in X-Men 41 when his son Legion accidentally went in time and tried to kill Magneto. But it's kind of like a kill Hitler in his bed kind of thing. But instead of killing Magneto, he killed his dad, and that's what caused Age of Apocalypse. And then Uncanny 163, he also he gets infested by a brood queen egg, which basically that's just aliens, you know, the xenomorphs. He gets an egg in him to become a brood queen. He dies. But then, I believe in that one, his girlfriend made a copy of him, and that's what they made. They made a copy of her boyfriend, and he got Xavier's mind in it. And then in X-Men 207, Bishop accidentally was trying to shoot Cable and shot Professor Xavier in the head, and he came back that time because Exodus, who's a very, very powerful telekinetic mutant, put his brain back together. And then some telepath, which telepath was it? I'm trying to remember from memory now. Somebody went and like fixed his brain, his mind. Like Exodus fixed the physical part, and then someone went in and fixed the mind. And that's how he came back. And then he died again in Avengers versus X-Men number 11, when Cyclops, who's gone a little bit crazy because the Phoenix Force destroyed him. Very similar to like X-Men The Last Stand movie, where Jean like evaporates Patrick Stewart. So long story short, Professor Xavier has died a lot. And that's often also why people are like, why is Xavier walking now? It's because like, oh, he died and then he got a new body. But then don't worry, he's going to go back to not being able to use his legs again, because that happens all the time too. The end of the episode that of the cartoon that introduces Magneto owning the school, that's also happens in the comics. Again, same issue that Xavier leaves the planet. This is also Uncanny X-Men 200, where Magneto is charged by Xavier, be like, hey, you should take care of the school while I go for a kip with my girlfriend in space, and I might not come back. So could you be dad now? I've been dad for a while. You be dad now. And that was an Uncanny X-Men 200 and 201. And so that kicked off a long time of Magneto playing Professor for a while, even not just to the X-Men, but to the New Mutants, which are the younger generation of the X-Men, like the new generation that Xavier gathered together. Speaking of which, the guy that the Friends of Humanity kidnap and Jubilee has her whole little precious moment on the roof of the school with, Roberto da Costa, he's from the comics, and he actually premiered in Marvel graphic novel number 4, which was the kickoff issue for the New Mutants before they launched New Mutants number 1. They introduced all the characters in this other graphic novel, and then in New Mutants number 1 he appeared, and he's very similar to how they depict him in the cartoon. He has solar energy powers, makes him strong, eventually learns to shoot with them. Eventually learns to do, I don't want to spoil what they might do with the cartoon, so he eventually learns to do a lot of cool stuff with his powers, and he's actually a really interesting character. He might be like a nod in the cartoon to them like gathering up more of the New Mutants, and if so, that'd be cool. I want the New Mutants. I want like Cannonball and Cypher and Wolfsbane and all them, because I didn't really like the movie. That's the same New Mutants. So this Roberto da Costa is the same guy from the movie. And then the final thing about the first episode that I wanted to address was a big, oh, it's one of the most beautiful sentences that I've ever heard in TV. They're having the big fight with the Sentinels, and they're kind of having a tit for tat and looking like they're on the X-Men are not going to be able to win this. But then Storm turns it up to 11, and the Sentinels turn and say, Omega level threat detected. I've talked multiple times on this show about Omega level mutants. I'm going to talk about it again, but I'm going to talk about it from just a chronological perspective on where that comes from. It is a long-standing argument on what Omega level mutant is and what does it mean. Because there was never, for a very long time, there was no specific classification of like level powers for mutants. You know, like, you watch Dragon Ball Z and his power is over 9,000. They did that. So in X-Men 208, which is in 1986, I was 2 years old, Nimrod, the futuristic super sentinel from an alternate reality timeline called Days of Future Past, who is now stuck in like present day timeline, he detects Rachel. Now, Rachel is she's the daughter of an alternate timeline, Scott and Jean. And he says that an Omega level classification is detected. And that's the first time that happens. And then that kicks off forever for people to be arguing what that means. And then in 2001, in a comic called X-Men Forever 3, X-Men Forever, Issue 3, a super advanced AI thing called Prosh that I don't want to get into what it is right now because you don't need to worry about it. He sends Jean Grey and a bunch of people back in time to see some things and to re-experience stuff. Very Christmas Carol, you know, ghosts sending you back in time to see stuff. Jean goes back and accesses a computer that Xavier's on and sees that Xavier describes the rest of her classmates like Cyclops, Angel, and Beast as nearing the limited potential of their powers that they could probably get more effective with through training, but could not increase in power levels. But her, Marvel Girl, that's what she was called at the time, and Iceman show limitless potential. And what a friend of his that he calls Fred, who he's referencing Frederick Duncan, who is a FBI agent he works with at the time, he described them as Omega level. So this is an issue that kind of institutes that Frederick's the one who coined the phrase and this classification of power levels. And then it's not till 2019, so 18 years later, we're up to like 35 years of people arguing and wondering what Omega level mutants mean and who is an Omega level mutant. Is Apocalypse one? Is Magneto one? What does someone nearing Omega level mutant levels mean? Is why did they call someone called Chamber potentially an Omega level mutant? It's just a big old thing that because X-Men is handed around to a lot of writers and a lot of editors, no one landed on a specific definition. But in 2019, in Jonathan Hickman's House of X number one, he was like, hold my beer, I'm going to define Omega level mutants. And he defines them similarly in description as previously stated, mutants with no upper limits to their powers. They could just constantly tap into more and more powerful versions of their powers. But then he goes one step further and he makes a list of all the Omega level mutants. And I'm not going to list them all right now because there's like, I think 19 is what he listed. But Storm is one of them. Storm is an Omega level mutant. And I think that might have been the first time they designated her that. Although no, I think they referenced it previously. Sorry, gonna check myself on just making weird conclusions. But Jean Grey and Iceman have been for a very long time designated as Omega level. Magneto is also Omega level. Funny enough, Professor X was not on the list, but people think that that's because Professor X made the list and didn't want to put himself on the list. So yeah, that's Omega level mutants, and to hear it in a cartoon and to see Storm look so cool, so cool, as she brings lightning down onto a desert and just forms glass around her and hands these sentinels their metallic butts. Chef's kiss good. So fantastic. A lot of people also wondered why she has her mohawk hair at this time. And I'm going to get into that theory in a second. But episode one, so fantastic. Love all the references. Love them throwing us into a very specific time in the 80s of the X-Men. That's where, I know this is X-Men 97, but they're really pulling a lot of stuff from the 80s. This is Claremont stories. Other than like Age of Apocalypse Morph and Master Mold, who was originally a Stanley and Jack Kirby creation, a lot of this stuff is Claremont. And in episode two, which is titled Mutant Liberation Begins, a lot more Claremont stuff happens. And I wanted to get into the big stuff right away. Because episode two opens up a can of worms of stories and is throwing a lot at the viewers and readers at the same time. The least of which is the appearance of a new character called the Executioner. Now, the Executioner is kind of flavor A of X-Men villains. I was talking to actually a friend earlier, and we were going over the fact that kind of all of X-Men villains can kind of be put in two categories, generally speaking, maybe three. I'll make up the third right now. The third is aliens. But the other two is either they are a human with bigoted beliefs, or they are a mutant with villainistic, also, I guess, bigoted beliefs against humans. The Executioner is the human version. He is in the comics and in the cartoon. I thought they maybe were going to give him a different name, but on the IMDb, the voice actor is listed as Carl Denti is the character. And that's who it is in the comics. He actually appears in X-Men Annual 17 for the first time. And funny enough, considering I just made reference in discussing about Omega level mutants to a character named Frederick Duncan, who is another human, is an FBI agent. Carl Denti is actually a friend of Frederick's who, upon Frederick's death, finds a cache of confiscated alien technology and weaponry that Frederick had been getting to get out of the hands of people who were trying to be mean to mutants. And Carl goes, well, I'm going to use this to deal with the mutant threat. And he puts on a wild costume. It is a bonkers look. Quite the idea to have if you're going to commit hate crimes. And he goes and does what basically this guy does in the cartoon. He tries to assassinate a bunch of mutants. Now, he doesn't show up to Magneto's trial in the comics, but he does go and basically he's the best way to describe him is that he is if the Punisher from Marvel Comics didn't like mutants instead of criminals. Because the Punisher is like, I'm going to take justice in my own hands and just put a bullet in criminals' heads. Executioner is like, I can do that, but for mutants. But speaking of Magneto's trial actually happens in Uncanny X-Men 200. Again, the same issue that Xavier leaves for another planet, and the same issue where Magneto says to Xavier, I will take care of your school. So these first two episodes are really leaning into Uncanny X-Men number 200, which was a big issue. It was, you know, the 200th issue of this comic. It was definitely something worth celebrating and worth making a big deal. And as you can tell, a lot happened in it. This comic had plenty for them to make the cartoon based off of, and I love it. I mean, even Magneto's costume in it is the costume he has in the cover of Uncanny X-Men 200 with that big old M symbol, and he's showing his muscles with that little short sleeve kind of look. I love it. Magneto actually, here's the story of why Magneto gets put on trial in the comics. He basically gets shot out of space, out of his asteroid, and almost dies upon reentry, and is saved by a human woman named Lee Forrester, who's out on this boat in the ocean, and she actually saves like Magneto from like sharks eating him. And he starts off like, she's like nursing him back to health, and he's like, I don't need your help, you dang dirty human. But then he learns to like her. And then he starts renouncing his, you know, ways of being mean to humans. And he's just like, oh, this lady is so nice. I guess maybe some humans are nice and I kind of love her. And because I love her, I'm going to try and be good. And so he then gets swept up to this big old fight with the Secret Wars and the Beyonder and the celestial being and everything like that. And I don't want to get into that right now because you don't need to know that right now. But long story short, that puts him with the X-Men and Professor X, who is like, oh, you want to be good guy now? I'll help you be a good guy now. And he lets Magneto stay at the school. And the X-Men are like, no, this is stupid. Do not do that. We've been fighting him for 200 issues. not 200 issues. This happens in like 188. But Magneto like hangs out for a while. And then it's not until Mystique shows up with her government sanctioned villain group. Kind of like a Thunderbolts or a Suicide Squad, but it's the government was like, Mystique, we will expunge your record of being a terrorist if you will then go do things for us to fight mutants. And she goes, okay, I don't want to go to prison, so I'll do that. And so she creates a thing called Freedom Force. Freedom Force shows up and goes, Magneto, you're under arrest. And they fight and they fight and they fight. And then Magneto goes, wait, because he's like saving the humans who are the bystanders and stuff like that. And he's like, you know what? I need to go and pay for my crimes with due process. And he turns himself in, similar to the cartoon. And he goes to trial. And the cartoon did a pretty good adaptation of coming up with the reason of why a UN trial would let Magneto go. In the comics, it's a little more complicated because he's got a little bit more complicated past. His defense lawyer brings up the fact that at one point Magneto was turned into a baby. Essentially, that version of Magneto was like killed and resurrected. And they were like, well, in that sense, you can't try this man for the crimes of a life that died. And they go, okay, we will do crimes that happened after that. And then they defend that all of the crimes that happened after that were all in defense. They were like defensive measures, which is what they bring up in the cartoon, that he's just trying to defend himself and defend his people and defend mutants. And then, similar to the cartoon, a bunch of terrorists try to attack the UN and then inadvertently attack humans. And actually some Nazis, some mutant Nazis called the Fenris twins. They show up and Magneto saves the humans. And so basically they go, okay, we're not going to sentence you to death, but we're also not going to acquit you, but we're going to say basically time served, which was your former life. And so that's how he gets off on his trial in the comics. In this issue, though, is not when Storm loses her powers like in the cartoon. Storm loses her powers actually before this. We're talking X-Men 200, and X-Men 185 is when she loses her powers. And that story goes back to X-Men 184, where it's the premiere of Forge, who is the maker. He's like a D&D artificer, and he creates a gun for the government. The government used to have a contract with Tony Stark. And then Tony's like, I don't want to make weapons for the government anymore. So Forge is like, I'll make weapons for the government. But he makes a gun to neutralize an alien threat. But it can specifically, or it can generally speaking, neutralize any superhuman's powers and essentially turn them into a human. A mundane human. But he's like, we're only going to use this for aliens. And the government assured me they're not going to take this gun and use it on mutants. So don't worry. And then everybody started worrying because they knew that that's not how the American government works. And that happened. That lasted for one issue. In episode one, in issue 185, the government's like, hey, this mutant terrorist criminal, Rogue, is with the X-Men. And so we need to go get her. Which this happens all the time, where the X-Men keep taking villains into their under their wing. And then the government's like, we got to try them. Like, they're people who did crimes. And the X-Men are like, but they're our friends, and we're going to take care of them, so you don't worry about it. Which makes sense why it culminated in the Krakoan era, where they are like a nation with diplomatic immunity. The government goes with this guy named Henry Peter Gyrick, who's a real tool. He's like, we're going to go get Rogue, and we're going to go attack her, and I've got this cool gun from my good buddy Forge that I'm going to use on her. And Mystique is the one who goes and tells Destiny, her wife, that she's like, they got the gun, they're going to use it on Rogue. And Destiny's like, you gonna save her? And Mystique's like, I don't know, I want Rogue back from the X-Men, because she's very mad that Rogue went to go join the X-Men, because Rogue used to be on her team, because that's her adopted daughter. And Mystique's like, I don't know, she might leave the X-Men and have a better life if she's a human. And Destiny's like, well, shouldn't she be the one who makes that choice? And Mystique's like, I don't know, I'm a very controlling mother, I think I might just control the situation. But she actually makes the good choice, tells Forge. Forge then goes and is like, what? They're going to use my gun on mutants? That's a no-no. And so when Henry Peter Gyrick assaults Rogue with like this big old little army force, he shoots her with a low level version of it, and it kind of scrambles her powers. But what had happened before that was that she had, upon Storm's consent, had taken Storm's powers. And so when the gun shot her, it kind of like only sort of neutralized her, but then she had Storm's powers, and then her control over Storm's powers got out of hand, and she was causing like a bad storm. And then Storm helped her to get it under control and save the humans from the storm that she created. And then Henry is like, I'm gonna shoot her again with a full setting. And Forge goes, no, and he knocks Henry to the side, and Henry's fire shot misfires and hits Storm. And then Forge is very sad that he made Storm a human, and then they have a whole adventure together. And I don't know if they're gonna put Forge, are they gonna put Forge in the cartoon? I can't remember if I saw Forge in the marketing materials. I was trying to stay away from marketing materials of the cartoon. Anyways, that's how Storm loses her powers, and she gets sad, and she goes and shaves her head into a mohawk, which is why people think that they started the show off with the mohawk, because if we saw like promotional material of her with a mohawk and not without a mohawk, we would have known this is going to happen. So I'm glad they didn't, because once this happened, heartbreaking in the cartoon. Heartbreaking. So sad. Most beautiful Omega level mutant ever, and she now human. But the good news is that in the comics, the era where Storm doesn't have powers is a really cool era of Storm. It's also a pretty gay era. She kind of gets a girlfriend in New York, which I'm all for Storm. I have a girlfriend. I'm good. I don't need to go to New York to get one. I like mine. So that happens. Genosha is also mentioned in the cartoon. I don't want to get into the history of Genosha. But the other thing, oh God, I'm looking at my list of stuff, and there's two more big things that happen in this episode. Okay, we're going to get through this. At the end of the episode, Rogue and Magneto have a little intimate moment and they touch skin to skin, and people might be like, what's that? And I'm even like, what's that? Because while this is a reference to comic book materials, I don't know how they're going to translate this into the cartoon, because here's what happened in the comics of when Rogue and Magneto were an item. Now, Rogue and Magneto have been an item. In Uncanny X-Men 169, Rogue hides in the Savage Land from Captain Marvel's ghost. Don't worry about it. And she meets up with Magneto in Uncanny X-Men 174, and she finds out she can touch Magneto because her powers are all wonky on the fritz. So it's not permanent. But because they're like in this sweaty dinosaur tropical land just kind of hanging out with a bunch of people there, she gets all intimate with Magneto. And everyone knows this costume because everyone has seen this costume, because it's when she's got the shredded, like, ripped up bikini and headband and is looking like something off of like an 80s rock album. And so they have a little moment there, but then Magneto kills somebody and Rogue goes, well, I'm not down with this. And so she doesn't want to be his girlfriend. But then in Uncanny X-Men 174, in Age of Apocalypse, sorry, rereading my notes. In Age of Apocalypse, she can touch Magneto. In fact, they're married and have a kid. And she can touch Magneto because she accidentally permanently absorbed Polaris's powers, which are magnetic, and they cancel each other out. But it's really sad because her powers are on the fritz and she can't touch her baby, because if she does, she'll hurt him. And so they're a couple in there, but that was an alternate reality timeline. And then later on, Magneto he didn't have a clone, but someone cloned Magneto, a younger version named Joseph, which we talked about just a couple episodes ago. When we were talking about what was going on in the comics in 1997. And her and Joseph were very close and intimate and almost became an item. But she always loved Gambit anyways. So that's what's going on with Rogue and Magneto in the comics. But I don't know how that's going to translate into the show, because this is an Age of Apocalypse and her powers are working fine. So it might be like, here's my theory. I'm going to throw out a theory and we'll see if it works out. You can join me in my theory world. My theory is that they're going to say that Magneto can control like the magnetic spectrum around his hands if he wants to, and Rogue can touch him because of that. Either that, or they're going to say like, oh, Rogue once touched Magneto, and because of that, well, that won't work. I don't know. We'll find out together. It's fun. We get to watch the show. Last big thing, which is a very big thing. Jean Grey has a baby in episode 2. And the baby's name is Nathan Charles Summers. Nathan Summers is the name of Cable. Jean is not Cable's mom. What happened is, well, not biological mom. We've talked about Madeline Pryor in this show. And I'm going to try to make Madeline Pryor make sense to someone who's never heard about Madeline Pryor before. So those of you who know Madeline Pryor, let me know if I did a pretty good job of making this very confusing character that I love from the comics make sense to people who don't know who she is. So Jean Grey becomes the Phoenix. The Phoenix goes crazy. Jean Grey destroys herself to save the world from the Phoenix. Scott is sad because his wife is dead. Scott goes to Alaska, meets a woman who looks identical to Jean, but her name is Madeline Pryor. Scott falls in love with her. They have baby, he gets her pregnant. And that's his new bride. And baby coming. Jean turns out to not be dead. The Phoenix was a copy of her. Jean's actual body is in a cocoon in the bottom of the Hudson and is now back to being alive. And Scott senses her, leaves his pregnant wife to go find Jean. Finds Jean, eventually remembers he has a wife with a baby, goes back to find them. It gets worse. While protecting the X-Men, Scott misses the birth of his son. He's not there for the birth of Nathan. Then, this is where it gets worse. He's off having adventures with Jean, doing like X-Men stuff. While he's doing that, Maddie gets kidnapped. No, Maddie gets attacked. He keeps it straight. Maddie gets attacked by the Marauders, and they take the baby. And she goes into hiding. And then Scott comes back and thinks they're both gone and can't find them. Maddie then goes into hiding with the X-Men after the Fall of the Mutants event and hides in Australia and hopes that Scott will find their baby eventually. And so I don't need to go on the rest of the story of Madeline Pryor, but when that lady who looks exactly like Jean showed up at the Xavier School in the cartoon, that's confusing and wonderful. Because that means there's definitely a Mr. Sinister story coming, that maybe the one person who gave birth to the baby in the cartoon is not Jean and actually Madeline Pryor. And we're going to get like Mr. Sinister stories, Madeline Pryor stories, Cable stories. We might even get Inferno. And if you want to know what Inferno is, go listen to my episode of this podcast where we talked about Inferno. But that's a big deal that Clone Jean showed up at the door, and I love it. It's messy. It's going to be drama, and I'm so here for this show. It is so good. Everyone is doing such a good job with the acting and the animation. All the old actors sound fantastic. I love them. The new voices are spot on. Friend of my friend's AJ voices Gambit. Fantastic job of recreating Gambit's voice. So good. New actor for the Cyclops, and the new writers for Cyclops make Cyclops even cooler than ever. And the cartoon Cyclops was always better than the comic Cyclops to a lot of people. I like the comic Cyclops a lot. He's interesting. But a lot of people didn't like him, and the cartoon's the better version. But in this version, he's even better. I'm so excited about this show. I'm so glad that Disney is finally using this IP for something cool. And I'm hoping that maybe this can kind of be a semi-regular thing that we might be able to do for the short amount of time that the show's coming out, because I would love to watch the show with you and help you understand it. And if you like that, subscribe to the show. And if you like it a lot, go to the Patreon. You can sign up at the Patreon and keep this show going for forever, just like the X-Men will keep going on for forever. Thank you so much. Be good, be kind, be brave, and I'll see you next time. Goodbye.